Welcome to Noir on the Radio with your host, Greg Barth. Greg is the author of Selena, Diesel Therapy, Suicide Lounge, Bonafide Jobs, and Where Moth and Rust Corrupt. He lives and writes in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Say hello to your host, Greg Barth. Greg, take it away.
Thanks, Pam. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Noir on the Radio. I'm your host, Greg Barth, and joining me tonight is our guest author, J.L. Abramo. J.L. Abramo was born in the seaside paradise of Brooklyn, New York, on Raymond Chandler's 59th birthday. Abramo earned a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology at the City College of New York and a Master's in Social Psychology at the University of Cincinnati. Abramo is the author of Catching Water in a Net, winner of the St. Martin's Press Private Eye Writers of America Prize for Best First Private Eye Novel, and the subsequent Jake Diamond novels, Clutching at Straws, Counting to Infinity, and Circling the Runway, Chasing Charlie Chan, a prequel to the Jake Diamond series, and the standalone thriller Gravesend. Abramo's latest work is Brooklyn Justice. So, Joe Abramo, welcome to Noir on the Radio. It's great to have you with us this evening.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Great to be with you.
So I want to talk about several things tonight. We'll talk about you and your career. We'll definitely spend some time on the books. And I'll have some questions around the craft of writing and how you do what you do. And then we'll also take a look at what's new and up and coming from you. So I've never been to Brooklyn, but I'm assuming it truly is a seaside paradise.
Well, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, Greg, people don't realize when you grow up as close to Coney Island as I did, that you, during the summer, we went to the beach literally every day. So, yeah, we grew up, beach kids. And, a lot of people don't associate New York with the beach, but it certainly was a beach culture.
That sounds very nice. So we will be available to take calls at any time tonight. So for the listeners out there, if you'd like to call in and talk to Joe, call in at any time during the broadcast. The number is 347-633-9609. And once again, that's 347-633-9609. So Joe, tell us a little bit about yourself. I didn't see former private investigator or police officer or journalist on your bio, but how would you say your education experience has helped you with your writing? Because it certainly rings true in respect to those professions, I would say.
Yeah, well, my education was mostly in education, teaching, and in sociology and then social psychology. And I think social psychology always have kind of an influence on the way I look at the world and the way I look at certain situations. Social psychology is more the examination of how people work in groups as opposed to individually or in the major society. So when you look at groups like church groups, police groups, any kind of groups, you find that the group has a different way of making decisions than the individual does. And it brings a little bit of knowledge to me about how certain groups operate when they come up in my writing. That's helped a lot in the way I look at things from a social psychological perspective. And I did do some journalism, a lot of arts journalism. I've done a lot of theater. My character Jake Diamond in the main series is a Brooklyn kid who wanted to be an actor and winds up coming out to L.A. to try to break into the movies. So I had a lot of theater experience and did a lot of theater journalism before I moved on to, writing crime fiction.
So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the Jake Diamond novels. So Jake is a private investigator in San Francisco. And just for anyone out there listening that hasn't picked up one of these novels yet, go ahead and introduce them to this guy.
Well, you know, it was an interesting story because it started out, I had written a book that was about Brooklyn detectives, NYPD Brooklyn detectives, in a precinct in the neighborhood where I grew up in Brooklyn. And I couldn't get anybody to look at it. So rather than getting frustrated and you know, kind of throwing everything out the window, I decided, well, let me sit down and write. And so I sat down and just for kind of kicks, I thought I'd try to write something different. So I thought writing first person, that would be new for me, something a little with a little more humor than the other work that I had done. So I wrote about literally, I don't know, about 10 pages of this thing that starts off in a private eye office in San Francisco. I chose San Francisco because it leans itself to that kind of, first-person narrative, San Francisco and L.A., you know, the classics, Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and whatnot. So I wrote this 10 pages, not knowing, you know, not thinking I was going to go very far with it. And then a couple of days later, I was surfing the internet, and I bumped into this contest, which was the St. Martin's Press Private Eye Writers of America contest for Best First Private Eye Novel. And, you know, I said to myself, well, Joe, that's kind of a coincidence. And so the deadline was less than a month away, and I said, well, let me try to see if I can write a private eye novel. I had no experience in it, really. I didn't really know how to write a mystery. But, you know, I just did it, you know, and I sent it in. I remember taking it to the post office in Columbia, South Carolina, and making sure that the post office clerk stamped it with, you know, with the date that was the deadline date, and put it in the mail. And you know, lo and behold, it won the contest. And so that's how the book got published. And they really liked the characters and the dialogue. The plot was, you know, a mess in the sense that it was my first time, and you know, you tend to make it a little too complicated because you're afraid that people are going to figure it out too soon. So I worked with the great late Ruth Cavan there at St. Martin's, and we, you know, we did the editing that was necessary, then I went to BoucherCon, the first BoucherCon, and I met a number of writers, and they were all very generous to me in terms of advice and whatnot. And I remember talking to Joe Lansdale, and he asked me, you know, what was up next. And I said, well, you know, I have this book that I wrote about these Brooklyn detectives and all. And said, well, you know, is it the same? Does it have the same character as the book that just got published, which was Catching Water in a Net? And I said, no. And he said, well, look, let me give you a little advice. Write a follow-up. St. Martin's Press is, you know, going to be much more interested in a series than doing a standalone at this point in your career. So I took the advice and, wrote a follow-up. And so the first three books were published by St. Martin's, and they were Jake Diamond books. And Jake Diamond is, as I said, you know, he came from Brooklyn. He went out to L.A. to try to get into the movies, and he had little success at that. And then when he was working on a movie that had to do with a private eye, an actual private eye came in to be a consultant. And he befriended Jake, and so Jake ultimately decided to leave acting and go into the PI business. And worked with Jimmy Pigeon, who was this other guy, and then in Santa Monica, and then ultimately went up to San Francisco and opened his own shop. And that's how Jake came about.
Well, that's a great story. And you won the contest, correct?
I won the contest, which included publication. So it broke through a lot of barriers because no publishers were looking at unsolicited manuscripts, and I couldn't get an agent because I couldn't write a query letter as well as I could write a book. So this kind of broke the door open for me, and And that contest is again sponsored by St. Lawrence Press and the Private Eye Writers of America, and so the Private Eye Writers of America was very instrumental in getting me started. And now the fourth Jake Diamond book, which came out last year, Circling the Runway, has just been nominated for a Seamus Award. And that's the Private Eye Writers of America Award. So it's kind of cool that they helped me get my start. And now, you know, I'm being recognized by my peers, and it's come full circle. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, congratulations. That is
thank
exciting.
You.
How would you say is Jake's background as an actor, is that important to him in his current role as a PI? Does he use those skills as he, you know, navigates these adventures?
Yeah, I think to some extent it does. And also the other thing about Jake Diamond, and, you know, I know this is called, you know, Noir on the Radio, but the Jake Diamond books are not, you know, say as noir as the latest book, Brooklyn Justice, was set to Brooklyn Private Eye, which we could talk about later if you like. But a lot of Private Eyes have been referred to as hard-boiled, right? I always kind of refer to Jake Diamond as over-easy. He's a much easier-going guy, and he's a lover of classic literature, so he's always read. He very seldom carries a firearm. You'll more usually find him carrying around a dog-eared paperback of a classic novel. And I work those into the plots of the books. In Catching Water in a Net, he's reading A Tale of Two Cities. And so I bring that into it, you know, so there's a relationship. So where in Dickens' book, of course, he's talking about London and Paris, in Catching Water in a Net, we're looking at San Francisco and L.A. And in the other Jake Diamond books, he's always reading a classic book, which I try to tie into the book. Now, as far as the acting, I think his sense of humor, the way he deals with people, I think he brings those kinds of skills. And, in fact, even in the second book, Clutching at Straws, as part of his investigation, he goes to Denver to take a small part in a movie so that he could get close to a suspect. And so, you know, I bring that in there, and that's kind of fun.
Now, I did notice the references to Hugo, the Hunchback of Notre Dame,
DeMoss, and others.
Would you say you're a fan of those writers? Is that
absolutely. And you know, when we talk about genre, Greg, to me, it's a little dangerous sometimes to pigeonhole your work in one genre or another. And I think we both know, as, you know, quote-unquote crime writers, that sometimes, you know, people consider crime writers as, you know, not literary writers. But, you know, that's far from the case. I mean, there are some great literary fiction that's crime fiction, you know, from, you know, Mystic River by Dennis Lehane. And then, you know, Crime and Punishment, Les Miserables, those books are crime novels, aren't they? I mean, they are, you know. So,
they are.
So for me, the genre is really the vehicle that the writer uses to take the journey. And it's the vehicle that you're most comfortable in. And that's where I found, you know, I was comfortable in that area. But what underlies the novel, the theme, if you will, as opposed to the plot, you know, that's the universal stuff. And that's the stuff that, you know, that you have to say, whether consciously or unconsciously. And, you know, you say it in a crime novel or a sci-fi novel or a Western or whatever. So, so genre is a little, I think, in one respect, it will attract those readers that like that, you know, that those particular kinds of books. But on the other hand, it could, it could, uh, it, it could turn away people who don't read those kinds of books because they don't think that there's something in there that's just more than, you know, cops and robbers or whatever. So, you know,
yeah,
so it's a funny thing. Genre is a funny thing. It can be an advantage and a disadvantage.
Excellent point, Joe. So while we're on the books, your latest collection, Brooklyn Justice, features a different private investigator, Nick Ventura, and it's a collection. Am I correct?
Yeah, and the way that started, Greg, I had been down with a friend down to Atlantic City, and I'm not big on that gambling thing, you know, I'm not a Las Vegas type of person, but it was a friend of mine, and it was a chance to get together, and I watched some poker, you know, the big stakes poker games, and the rhythm and the way that the game, watching the game, it was very fascinating because it's almost, it's almost without punctuation, and I thought it would be kind of fun to try to write. Describe a game like that, you know. I started writing without a lot of punctuation because it just moves along. And then as we crime writers tend to do, you know, at the end of the game, somebody's going to get killed, okay? And I said, well, you know, this could make a kind of a fun short story. But as I continued to write, I realized that it wasn't, it was too long for a short story. But I didn't want to force it into a novel, so it turned out to be about a 22,000 word novella, if you will, called Pocket Queens. And then after that, this new character, Nick Ventura, who I wanted to write a character who was a little kind of darker and a little tougher than Jake Diamond, a Brooklyn guy, grew up in Brooklyn, you know, Italian American. Office in Coney Island above a pizzeria, that kind of thing. Just to kind of have a different type of character to write, you know.
Over easy.
Not as over easy, a little more hard boiled. You know, a guy who's willing to, get his hands dirty, more quickly than Jake would. And after
Absolutely.
I finished the novella, all of a sudden all these ideas came. To situations for Nick Ventura, you know, he's pushing me along, and I quickly wrote, five short stories with him as a character, and so I had it that, you know, the Pocket Queens and then the five short stories that follow it, they're all sequential, and they cover a period of like only 10 months, and they have Nick Ventura and other common characters, so it became, kind of a, it's almost like a novel in parts, in a sense. You know, although you can read them individually as a novella and short stories, they're all tied together. And, you know, that's the way that developed.
Right. So, you know, one thing that stands out in these, the stories, the novels, really all of them, whether it's an Atlantic City card game or San Francisco or L.A. or Brooklyn, they carry a strong sense of place. It's like you know the geography well. I really feel like I could take the novels and find my way around, you know, the city of San Francisco by reading these. How accurate are your locations, and is that something that's important to you as you plan your stories?
Yeah, it is important. I'd like books that take me to the places where they're set. And, I've always admired, contemporary writers who write with a strong sense of place. To mention Dennis Lehane again, you know, his Boston, Lauren Estleman's Detroit, that kind of thing. And so when I write, I always feel that where the story is set is almost like a character. It's a part of the story. And so in terms of accuracy, I'm very, very concerned about being accurate. So even when I write Brooklyn, I mean, Gravesend, the novel Gravesend, You know, Gravesend is the neighborhood in Brooklyn where I grew up, and as well as I know it, you know, I still, you know, had to check things out and make sure that, you know, that everything was right. And San Francisco, I've lived in San Francisco, but still I do a lot of checking. And then there's a couple of places where Jake Diamond winds up, like, say, L.A. or Chicago, that I'm not that familiar with. So I do a lot of research, because the one thing that will turn a reader off really quickly is if you have two people meeting on a street corner of two streets that don't actually, you know, intersect. That'll kick you right out of the story. So, you know, it's very important to be accurate about it geographically, of course. And then, you know, the sense of it. And a lot of what I do to capture the sense of places is through food. You'll find food a lot throughout all the books, and food that's specific to the place where it's taking place. And I'm not talking about, you know, a recipe book. I'm just talking about where they decide to meet. And so, you know, when they're in Chicago, you know, they go to a pizza joint. And, you know, when they're in L.A., they go to the famous Philippe's, which is the famous French dip where the French dip originated. And when they're in Brooklyn, of course, they're eating a lot of Italian food. So, but you know, I use it in a sense to kind of give a feel for the neighborhoods, and you know, Gravesend and Brooklyn. There's something interesting about Brooklyn, Greg. Although it could be the fourth largest city in the United States, you know, at 4 million plus people, it is in a sense, and particularly when I was growing up, almost like a small town, because we all lived in, you know, neighborhoods that were very homogeneous in terms of ethnics. You know, all Italians here are all Irish, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, I try to bring that sense. In Gravesend, for instance, there's a lot of situations where characters in the book cross paths with each other on the street, but they don't, of course, know that they are. You get that sense of, you know, it's a, in a sense, it's a kind of a small place where that can happen. And then, you know, eventually, you know, they all converge at the, you know, in the climax at the end of the book, you know.
Well, I've never been to Brooklyn, but Gravesend makes me feel like I've been there, particularly in the winter.
Well, yeah, Brooklyn, Brooklyn is a great place. I strongly recommend it. You know, Thomas Wolfe was a great Southern writer. You know, he wrote Look Home an Angel and Why Not, but he spent time in Brooklyn. And he wrote a short story, maybe back in the 40s, I'm thinking, called Only the Dead Know Brooklyn. And it's two guys meet on a subway station. And the idea is that there's so much to see in Brooklyn that you can never see it all in a lifetime. So Only the Dead Know Brooklyn. That's the way he did it. And it's like that. Brooklyn is, you could spend quite a long time before you saw every corner and everything there is to see in that particular place.
Right. So just a reminder to anyone that would like to call in and talk to J.L. Abramo, that number is 347-633-9609. And this is a copyrighted broadcast, solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. That number, once again, is 347-633-9609. Joe, one thing that strikes me with your novels as well, they bring with them quite a cast. We meet a lot of people on the page, and you have some interesting ensemble characters that really add to the entertainment of the stories. Vinny Stradivarius is one that comes to mind, but there's also many others. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you talk to us about how you use these characters to drive tension, plot points, comedy, et cetera, because there's really a rich group of people that we get to interact with on your pages.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, each of the characters, I think, I feel compliment Jake in one way or the other. You know, Vinny Stradivarius, Vinny Strings, is a kid who's he's a gambler, and you know, he's a kid that Jake kind of inherited from Jimmy Pigeon. Let me say a word about Jimmy Pigeon now, Greg, if you don't mind. At the very beginning of Catching an Order in the Net, Jake Diamond is visited by a woman at his office in San Francisco who's trying to get him to work a case for her, and it involves the death of Jimmy Pigeon. And this is the first he heard that Jimmy Pigeon was dead. And Jimmy Pigeon, of course, was his mentor, the person that brought him into the business. And so it's a shock to him. And you know, his first reaction is, you know, why am I hearing about this from a stranger? And if Jimmy was in trouble, why didn't he reach out to me? And I think that he comes to realize that it's because he wasn't making himself accessible. And so part of the underlying theme of that book is about, you know, friendship and the responsibility of friendship and whatnot. But Jimmy comes up in the following books when Jake is, you know, thinking what would Jimmy do in a situation like this, things that he learned from Jimmy. And then ultimately I became interested in who's this Jimmy Pigeon character who I killed off before I got, you know, to know who he was. And that's how Chasing Charlie Chan evolved. I went back in time to 1994 and made Jimmy Pigeon the main character. You know, that's what we can do as authors, is bring people back to life. We're like God, you know. And so, you know, that's what happened with Chasing Charlie Chan. And you know, Vinny's story, you know, starts with Jimmy Pigeon, and then after Jimmy Pigeon was killed, you know, Jake kind of took him under his wing. And, you know, Vinny adds that, you know, kind of a character who's, you know, he's always in the way, but every once in a while he miraculously helps out. You know, I think it's a nice relationship. And the thing of recurring characters, of course, as you know, with series, besides the main character, is that you have a chance to look at more than one person in terms of, you know, their history and backstory, and how they, you know, how they evolve or mature or whatever. You know, Darlene Roman, who's Jake's you know, associate, she's this, you know, she's the, you know, the perfect, you know, straight man for Jake, because there's a lot of humor in the book. So she's, you know, a very important character. You know, Joey Clams or Joey Russo is that mysterious guy. You don't know, you know, is he a mafia guy? What is he? But he's somebody that helps Jake out a lot. You know, Jake needs some help when it comes to dealing with, you know, tougher situations or tougher characters. And then there's a number of other characters that pop in and out of the books, like, you know, Willie Dogtail, which is, you know, his Native American friend down in L.A., which gives him, you know, a place to stop when he's going down there. And I think all these characters, the recurring characters, are, you know, they're important to kind of, you know, color it and complement and help, you know, Jake get through, you know, his day. Now, in terms of characters in general, you know, there are a lot of characters in the books. I mean, you look at Gravesend, you know, and I remember hearing after Catching Water in the Net, I got some feedback from some people that said, you know, I love the book, it was great, but there's so many characters that I felt like I had to keep going back to, you know, to see who was who. And so for the second book and all the books following that, I put a cast of characters at the beginning of the book, you'll notice, know, and so that people can refer to that, and people really like that. So, of course, if you look at Gravesend, there's two pages of characters, but at least it's an easy reference if you've forgotten who this particular person was to go back and find them. The fact that I can keep them all in my head is a miracle, but, you know, it's fun because, I mean, that's the way life is and that's the way the world is. It's not a two-person show. And, you know, in terms of good guys and bad guys, you know, there's some very bad guys. And then there's some, you know, some that are not so bad, that there's a, that we, that the reader hopefully has, you know, a little empathy for. And I think that's important also, that there'd be characters who don't necessarily do the right thing all the time, but aren't, you know, real, they aren't evil, evil, you know. And even in, and when we talk about noir, you know, more specifically, and that's why, you know, Nick Ventura is more noir than Jack Diamond, is that, you know, Nick Ventura will do things that, you know, that, that are, you know, pretty much against the law when he feels it's necessary. But, you know, you want the reader to allow a certain amount of divergence if it's, you know, if it's a good, you know, if it's a good purpose, you know, the ends and the means and whatnot. So, because, you know, noir is about, you know, kind of imperfect, you know, imperfect characters, they have their own, problems, their own dark side, whatever. That's where, you know, that's where it comes from.
The nuanced characters, you handle those very, very well. You have a short story, Mysterious Ways, which was featured in the recent collection, Unloaded, Crime Writers Writing Without Guns, which is an anthology that, you know, carries with it a call for responsible gun control to reduce the amount of gun violence in the country. How is this an important cause to you, and what do you hope to achieve as your part in that anthology?
I think on the most basic level, if books are sold, you know, the money goes to an organization who deals with that and knows what that is all about, you know, the politics of it and so on and so forth. So in the sense that it's a, you know, it's a benefit for that, you know, I was glad to contribute. In terms of, you know, the stories themselves, I mean, I don't know, you know, it's tough to say, because whether you kill somebody with a gun or with a, you know, with a crowbar or a bow and arrow, you know, it's still the same thing in a sense. So I don't know, you know, how much it was a fun exercise, you know, to do that. And, you know, I made it a Jake Diamond story because, as I said, Jake doesn't usually tote a gun, so it wasn't, you know, too problematic for me. You know, there was a lot of negative reaction to the book from, you know, gun people. And you know, that was really uncalled for, because if they read the book, they would see that, you know, the stories themselves are not, you know, soapbox against guns or anything. They're just stories that just happen to not have guns in them. And, you know, they could, you could, it could almost be argued, you know, their argument, you know, there's an argument that says guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, you know, the stories in that book can be an argument for that, because people are still getting killed. They're just not getting killed by guns. But, you know, I hope that it gains, you know, readership, because, you know, I was very, you know, Joyce Carol Oates and Joel Lansdale and, you know, a number of authors that I, you know, really admire. I think Eric Biener did a great job putting it together, and I think it's a solid anthology. You know, anthologies are not a great, you know, not a an easy thing to sell, Greg, but I think they're good to do. Because, you know, I mean, they get you out there. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be invited to do, I was invited to do a story for the BoucherCon anthology last year, Murder Under the Oaks, which Art Taylor edited, and that's a great collection. And then I have stories in two upcoming anthologies, which were fun, because one is called Mama Tried, crime short stories inspired by outlaw country songs.
So
everybody, you know, picked a song and wrote a story that kind of based or inspired by that song. And so, you know, that's coming out in time for Bhakti Harm Mama Tribe, and then another anthology, which is Coast to Coast, and this is Private Eyes from Coast to Coast, so they're going to have Private Eyes stories, Private Eyes in different cities around America, and so I have a Nick Ventura story coming in that, and you know, I enjoy doing that. It's kind of it's a little new to me, the short story. I always thought a short story would be simple because it's short, but I think probably as you know, it's quite challenging because you have to get it all in there in a short span of time. So you know, it's something that I'm learning.
Yeah, no, I agree. Short stories are tough. I would rather write, you know, a 1,000-page novel than a short story, or heaven forbid, one of those query letters we were talking about. But let's turn now to, you know, kind of the craft of writing itself. Who would you list as your major influences as a writer?
Well, you know, again, I don't write, you know, I don't write like Dickens or Dostoevsky or Victor Hugo. But, you know, I've always been very influenced by classic literature. You know, when you talk about Dickens, you know, you're talking about characters. I mean, you know, you're talking about loads of characters. You know, I've always enjoyed that. And the sense of place, you know, of London. And when you talk about, you know, you talk about Dostoevsky, you're talking about characters. And it's interesting because when people were saying, you have so many characters, you know, we can't keep track of them all. I said, well, you know, try reading Crime and Punishment, you know, because not only does it have like 50 characters, but you can't even pronounce their name, you know. And so, you know, I learned to follow that, and I think that's helped me in my writing and being able to introduce a lot of characters and keep it all straight. More contemporary writers, Kurt Vonnegut, you know, I like Kurt Vonnegut, and I think that's what kind of contributed to, you know, the way I write dialogue and the humor that comes out in the Jake Diamond books, and, you know, maybe the shorter chapters type of thing. And you know, I mean, of course, you know, we've all been, influenced by, Raymond Chandler and James Cain is a big favorite of mine. Postman Always Rings Twice and Double Indemnity. You know, I think he really moved things in a different direction. To me, he moved it from the Private Eye novel, Philip Marlowe, to the noir thing, where there's not necessarily a private eye, but there's that, you know, the guy who meets the woman who wants him to kill her husband type of thing. And that kind of started that whole ball rolling, which eventually, you know, led to, you know, writers like, you know, Jim Thompson and stuff like that. So, James Cain, you know, was always a favorite of mine. And, you know, contemporary writers, you know, there's a lot of good ones out there, as you know. When you say influence, it's not a question of you know, trying to imitate or anything like that, but, you know, to give you kind of a sense of what a good book is, what a good book should include, if you understand what I'm saying, you know. And so, you know, writers like, Dennis Lehane is one of my favorites, books like Absent Friends by S.J. Roseanne, beautiful post 9/11 book. These are books about people, you know, that and how they interact and how they deal with adversity. You know, how do you deal with adversity? Do you allow it to make you a bad person, or do you rise above it and conquer it? And I think that's what I try to bring into my books. You know, Gravesend is all about the people. It's all about the people, Greg. It's, you know, what's the other stuff that's going on, you know, the cases they're involved in and so on and so forth. But it's about people and family, too. family is always an important part of what I write, because, you know, family was always an important part of my life growing up. And so there's always, you know, fathers and sons things going on and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's fascinating. A very, you know, wide range of influences there, and it's I agree. You know, everything kind of goes back. Where would we be without James Cain? In circling the runway, you know, from a stylistic standpoint, you kind of alternate between first person and third person points of view, kind of going back
mm-hmm.
and forth between
mm-hmm.
PI investigation, police procedural. This is something I do quite a bit of as well in my novels, the first person, third person POV thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I first saw James Patterson doing that, and I think he publishes, you know, maybe a book a week now. So I thought it'd be okay for me to do it. And
it
certainly helps add complexity to the storylines. But I'm curious about, you know, your take on that technique.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's almost like it almost what the story lends itself to. You know, the first two Jake Diamond books were strictly first person. In the third book, we get to a place where Joey is, you know, something happens, you know, I won't, you know, no spoilers, something happens that gets, you know, mild-mannered Jake Diamond, you know, out of control, and he's ready to go kill somebody. And Joey has to kind of rear him back in and saying, you know, no, we're not going to do that. What we're going to do is we'll ruin the guy, you know, but, you know, you don't have to go out and kill somebody. And so Joey comes up with this plan that involves a lot of our, you know, favorite characters, which is almost like a Mission Impossible, where they go to Chicago and they all, like, play different roles to kind of, you know, sting this guy, so to speak. But the first part of that plan doesn't include Jake. He, you know, he stays back in San Francisco while they all go to Chicago to, you know, to set this up for when he's finally going to arrive. And so, of course, I couldn't be first person anymore. So the first two parts of the book are first person, and the third part of the book is third person because he's not there. So how is he going to narrate it? And that it was necessary, but it was kind of fun because, you know, I was getting, you know, it was a little variety. And when I started circling the runway, the situation, the way it starts, you know, with the intrusion at a high rise in San Francisco, the way it started and on St. Patrick's Day and all of that, it lended itself to third person. But, you know, but Jake's with his friends in a cab during that, you know, the first part of the book in the third person, you know. But then when I got to this, you know, the second chapter, and I wanted to have Jake, you know, waking up after a hangover of St. Patrick's Day, I just started writing in a first person. And so it just lended itself to that, Greg. And then the alternating really made a lot of sense. And I think it worked out very well.
I would agree. I think so, too. So let's, if you could let people know where they can find you out there on the web, you know, what you've got up and coming, because I'm sure a lot of people who have not checked out anything by J.L. Abramo at this point will be interested in doing so.
Well, yeah, we hope so. Well, you know, I have a website, of course, and that's just J.L. Abramo, no spaces or anything, J.L. Abramo, A-B-R-A-M-O, .com, and you know, there's pretty much everything you want to know on there. And then I have a Facebook page under J.L. Abramo, which is probably not too hard to Google. And then, you know, the books are available, you know, as e-books, Kindle books, notebooks, whatever, and also in trade paperback through, you know, any online, Barnes & Noble or Amazon. You know, of course, it can be ordered from, you know, they're not, you know, it's hard to find them stocked in bookstores, which is, you know, part of the independent publishing thing. But you know, I have a great publisher down and out who kind of rescued Jake Diamond from obscurity because Eric Campbell was always a big fan of Jake Diamond, and when he decided to start doing ebooks and bringing books back that were out of print, he reached out to me and said, "You know, I really love those Jake Diamond books. Would you be interested in getting them out there again?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, I would." And then ultimately, he went with Gravesend, which was really, you know, like the first, you know, new work that he did, and then ultimately went to doing, you know, print editions too, trade paperbacks. And the funny thing, Greg, is that Gravesend, after all the work over 10 years of, you know, reworking and so on, that's that first book that I tried to sell back before I wrote the Jake Diamond book. So it was kind of a thrill after, you know, all that time to finally see it, you know, get out there on the streets, because it was an important kind of a personal book for me.
Nice.
I'm not hard to find. You know, J.L. Abramo on Google, you know, make you take you to all the places you need to be. And of course, you know, as we know, people can always read a sample of the book on Amazon or whatever, a few chapters, and see if it, you know, if it captures their interest. Then, you know, hopefully they'll, you know, they'll go on and, you know, get the book and read the whole thing and maybe be interested in the series and whatnot.
I just would encourage everyone to go ahead. I'll let you finish. What's coming up next?
Oh, yeah. So coming up next is it's going to be a follow up to Gravesend, actually. So it'll have the you know, most of the same characters from that book, and again those guys were you know, Brooklyn detectives, and you know, they all have their stories and their families and whatnot, and you know, I just felt that there was more to say about them. So that'll be you know, coming out either later this year or early next year, and that'll be kind of a, you know, the sequel, so to speak, of Gravesend in Brooklyn.
Great. Well, J.L. Abramo, thank you for joining us on Noir on the Radio this evening. Good luck with the Seamus.
My pleasure.
Awarded. It has indeed been a pleasure talking to you, and I encourage everyone out there to check out Abramo's novels, available just a mouse click away. So, folks, this is Greg Barth, your host, wishing you a great night of noir reading. And until next time, and Pam, did you have something to close us out with?
I do. I wanted to let everybody know on Friday on Authors on the Air, John Lesquois is joining me for a live interview. We're going to be discussing his new book and his award that he was given at Thriller Fest called the Silver Bullet Award. And thank you, Greg, for sitting in tonight. And thank you, Joe Abramo. It was really great listening to you both.
Thank you very much.
Right,
and you guys have a great night.
Have a great evening.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Good night. And good night, Greg. Thank you.
Good night.
All right, folks, and that's it for tonight. Have a great evening, and we'll see you on Friday.